Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Goodness, truth, beauty. The world, according to Dante. The influential historian of medieval philosophy, Etienne Gilson, warned, "When a philosopher discusses literature, he often reveals a want of taste. But when a man of letters discusses ideas, he sometimes reveals a lack of precision." Gilson was prefacing his own reflections on Dante and philosophy, which will also be my aim, and his quip captures only one of many reasons why Dante is daunting to discuss. Dante is a philosophical poet, so attending to his philosophy risks neglecting his poetry, while considering his poetry risks neglecting his philosophy. Gilson didn't escape the problem, by the way, and even in focusing on the question of what kind of philosopher Dante was, I think his book suffers from deficiencies both in precision, or grasp of intelligible truth, and in taste, or appreciation of appealing beauty. Particularly on such questions as what it means to be a Thomist, what it means to be a poet, and what it means to be a Christian philosopher and a Christian poet. Father Kevin Flannery called Gilson's book ungenerous, contrasting it with a very generous book about Dante by Ralph McInerney, which itself only briefly acknowledges but does not stoop to engage with Gilson. Apart from the arguments of Thomists, philosophers, and theologians, Dante has been interpreted, praised, and judged by poets and literary critics, by psychologists and cultural critics, by learned popes and humble pastors. And all of that is just to name the amateurs, leaving aside the professional dantisti, scholars who study his life and works, including a range of specialists: historians, political theorists, linguists, literary theorists, commentators, including even cryptographers and numerologists. Dante experts shape and engage in established and difficult to negotiate debates about Dante's life, the relation between his works, his use of sources, his literary artistry, his personal experience and sense of self, his perspective on the church, and his attitude to political authorities. Hardly any well-lettered person has refrained from commenting on Dante, and a surprising number have taken to translating him. In English alone, there are well more than 100 translations of Dante's Inferno and more than 85 of the whole Divine Comedy. This was published just this year. So just another amateur approaching this well-loved figure, it is prudent for me to begin by circumscribing what I am about to talk about, which inevitably leaves aside many legitimate questions, interesting angles, interpretive frameworks, and worthy concerns. I will indirectly address, for those who are interested in such things, some questions that Dante scholars argue about, including the sense in which Dante is a Thomist, the relation between his poetry and his philosophy, and how he uses sources. I will also include, for the sake of those who are new to Dante, a brief overview of the Divine Comedy. But to give my talk some manageable coherence, I will focus on one part of the comedy, the last and least commonly discussed part, Paradiso. Within Paradiso, I want to highlight two particular themes: virtues and the divine names, including virtues as divine names. To draw out these themes, I will discuss primarily three features of the Paradiso: the imaginative challenge of describing the life of souls in heaven, the intellectual challenge of structuring Dante's heavenly journey, and Dante's use of philosophy to meet both of these challenges. As a preview to where we are headed, my title answers an implicit question, or asks an implicit question, the preliminary answer to which is something like this: Dante's world, is one wholly informed by active causes, which are refractions of and participations in an original and perfectly active cause, namely God. Beauty, truth, and goodness are just some of the many names for this first cause and for all creaturely participations in this cause. And as rational creatures, we are, by our own intrinsic nature and with the extrinsic help of the first cause, moved to know and to love and to enjoy peace in this cause. I hope the rest of what I say will help to flesh out the significance of that summary. Dante's Commedia, or Comedy, almost immediately acclaimed as the Divine Comedy, is a poem of 100 songs, or cantos, collected into three sections, or canticles: Inferno, consisting of 34 cantos, and Purgatorio and Paradiso, each with 33 cantos. Individual cantos are each made up of about 130 to 150 lines of poetry, composed according to a consistent and distinctive schema. Each line is 11 syllables, and Italian allows for some flexibility in where a stress is placed in the line, usually the fourth or the sixth beat, before reaching the second to last syllable, which is always stressed. In English translations, it is common to try to approximate this with iambic pentameter, that is 10 beats per line with alternating stress patterns. To my ear, the English final stress lacks the musicality of the Italian penultimate stress, which evokes a gentle mixture of movement and rest. Take the first stanza of Paradiso, and this will be the only Italian I inflict on you. La gloria di colui che tutto muove, per l'universo penetra e risplende, in una parte più e meno altrove. Here is Dorothy Sayers English. The glory of him who moves all things soe'er impenetrates the universe and bright. The splendor burns, more here and lesser there. I think that's beautiful, but even in a few brief lines and without having to know any Italian, I think you can feel the different tone. Perhaps it is subtle, but it is there. Pushed wider and exaggerated, that difference would open up to the gap between a march and a dance, or between an American musical and an Italian opera. The example also serves to illustrate that Dante's lines are arranged into stanzas of three, or tercets. This allows a distinctive rhyme scheme. Apparently, Dante's own invention, terza rima, weaves stanzas together with alternating pairs of lines in the rhyming pattern A-B-A, B-C-B, C-D-C, etc. Like an intricate fractal, then, Dante's poem reflects at every scale the whole, the cantos, the tercets, the interlacing rhyme scheme, the classical and Christian respect for triads. One of the reasons that there are so many English translations, apart from the appreciation that translators have for the text and the appetite that readers have to discover the spirit of Dante, is that Dante's form works well in Italian but forces English translators to find their own creative balance between fidelity to meaning and fidelity to musicality, and each of these in different ways. There are some translations that try to replicate the rhyme scheme, as does Dorothy Sayers. But more often, translators take a looser approach, seeking to capture the flow of the lines without strict rhyming, and others even embrace free verse. There are even relatively unpoetic literal prose approaches to rendering Dante's meaning. People tend to have favorite translations, but all admit that none is perfect. That is about all I will say about the work's poetic form, except to note that, while strict, it allows for a range of voices and moods. Scholars argue over whether the overall work is more epic or lyric, but within its 100 cantos, Dante shows a remarkable flexibility of imagery and poetic style, including laments and dirges, extended metaphors and allegories, hymns of praise, petitions, confessions, remonstrations, playful digressions, dialectical inquiries, prayers, exclamations of rapture, and more, all of which, of course, display Dante's literary mastery through allusions and creative synthesis. Dante, though, is never only showing off. His display of poetic range always serves the overall purpose of the story, which is to describe and invite the reader to accompany a dramatic, personal, and deeply spiritual journey. Dante himself is the main character, a risky literary conceit that can be seen as either presumptuous or humble, and which requires readers occasionally to distinguish and speculate about the relations between Dante, the historical author, Dante, the poetic voice of the narrator, and Dante, the narrated protagonist of the story. This has even spawned a, to my mind, mostly unnecessary literature about the sense in which Dante's story is true. Maybe the three Dantes are distinct personas of one mysteriously unified nature. In any case, as Dante tells it, midway through his life, he finds himself lost, and so drawn to reflect on his own place in the Christian drama of sin, healing, and redemption, thus setting him upon a path which turns out to be a long journey through hell, purgatory, and heaven. The poem recounts not only a tour of the various places and possibilities of the afterlife, but a personal process of redemption, a chance for Dante to reflect on his sins and to practice purification, all under God's providential grace, drawing him beyond himself to receive the gift of salvation and enjoy a foretaste of the bliss of heaven. The afterlife journey itself is not entirely novel. There are precedents for such stories, of which Dante was aware and on which he draws with creative synthesis and artistic innovation. For the passage through the underworld, he makes nods to episodes from Homer and Virgil. And for the description of Paradiso, he had in mind passages from Cicero, something called the Dream of Scipio, and Plato, like the Myth of Air at the end of the Republic, and even Neoplatonic commentaries and elaborations of these. Dante makes progress along this journey with the help of guides, who are at once poetically symbolic, narratively useful, and dialectically enlightening. The first and longest accompanying guide is Virgil, fellow poet and exemplar of pagan wisdom, who can explain things to Dante with philosophical reason. Since all is under God's providence, Virgil has some sense of what he is missing, as though and though unaided by the gift of supernatural faith, he is soberly, even tragically aware that he was sent by the intercession of Beatrice, Dante's longed-for beloved, to lead Dante on the longest leg of the journey through hell and up Mount Purgatory. From the top of Purgatory and through most of heaven, Beatrice herself is Dante's guide. Enlightened by the grace of faith, she is not only fit to be present in heaven, she can explain what Dante encounters there with the perspective of a Christian faith, which nonetheless is notably not without a firm grounding in philosophy. At the outer reaches of the heavens, on the final leg of Dante's journey to God, Beatrice is replaced by the great mystical saint and doctor of the church, Bernard of Clairvaux, known for his writings on divine love. Bernard ushers Dante on the last steps of his journey into the ineffable mystery of God's presence. The Inferno and the Purgatorio have had more readers. They are more commonly appreciated and more commonly assigned, and they are more commonly discussed than Paradiso. Both have inspired memorable artistic maps of their terrain. You have probably seen these. The most famous image of the structure and inhabitants of hell is by Sandro Botticelli from the late 15th century, a parchment illustration now in the Vatican Library. It illustrates Dante's conception of hell as a pit, with each level descending into more serious sins, measured by the degree to which they betray our rational and social nature. Hell is an inverted city, a depiction of people suffering the consequences of having rendered themselves unfit for friendship with each other and with God. Of Purgatory's structure and inhabitants, the most famous image is Domenico de Michelini's painting, also from the late 15th century, which is high on a wall of the north nave of Santa Maria del Fiore, the Duomo, in Florence. Dante is in the foreground, solemnly holding open a page with the first lines of the comedy, and in the background, over his right shoulder, is a mountain with seven levels, populated by sinners, purging themselves of the relevant one of the seven deadly sins. It is noteworthy that there is no comparably famous image of Paradiso, no distinctly artistic map, no renowned illustrations of its geography, or rather cosmography, or of the order and arrangement of the saints there. This lack suggests the challenge not only for an artist, but for any reader trying to visualize paradise, which is by design the most abstracted from the realm of the senses and the realm of familiar physical representation. The reputation of Paradiso, that it is more intellectual, less dramatic, and yes, people say, more boring, is a function of it being a place of perfect order and harmony. The poet Dante set himself the challenge of drawing us into the presence of what is in itself ineffable, beyond sense and word. It is almost necessary that drama itself needs to be absent here, from the setting and even from the character Dante, who has now been purified and is capable of a sustained interior peace. Even as he grants us a heavenly structure, a shape for progress towards the divine, the poet takes it back as a pedagogical trick. The pilgrim's experience is of passing through different levels of heaven, encountering different saints at each level, but it turns out that these are not so much different places as different refractions through lower planes of the one real highest place, the Empyrean, the tenth heaven, where in fact the saints dwell together with God. While there are no famous artistic renderings, one can find useful charts and schematics of the heavenly spheres. These often encompass hell and purgatory too, now in perspective and quite small. Hell, inverted, is a hole into the bottom of the earth, out of which, emerging from the other side, protrudes purgatory at the top of the earth, pointing up to the heavens. In concentric rings above the earth are seven levels according to the seven planets, in order from distance from the earth: the moon, Mercury, Venus, the sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Each is a heaven. The astronomical planets, as material objects following an orbit, are also noble sentinels marking out their proper luminously transparent spheres, an ordered hierarchy of spiritual domains encompassing the earth. Beyond Saturn, that is the seventh heaven, is the eighth sphere of the fixed stars, and beyond that is the first moved, the primum mobile, the ninth and highest and most encompassing of the heavenly spheres. Almost none of this conception of heaven is new. Dante is drawing from spiritualized descriptions of common sense of observable astronomy which go back to ancient Greece. And he is drawing on philosophical interpretations by Plato and Christian and medieval embellishments, for instance, having each of those nine levels associated with ranks of angels, as described by Pseudo-Dionysius, and having the first seven levels associated with the seven liberal arts. The moon, Mercury, and Venus correspond to the linguistic arts of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. The sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn correspond to the arts of order and proportion, arithmetic, music, geometry, and astronomy. All of this spiritual cosmology supplies Dante the poet with a framework for the narrative progress of Dante the character, and it also illustrates the point that there are grades of blessedness in heaven, that even blessed souls, united in the presence of God, retain their particularity, their order, their distinction. God, in this picture, is represented as a point, which is to say, as transcending physical space and time. We may think we have advanced far beyond Dante's cosmography, but in a way, his picture fits and even anticipates what modern physics has discovered by a different route. Consider, given that the speed of light is not instantaneous, we now know that when we look out at the heavens, the farther away the heavenly bodies we see, the more abstracted they are from the present. Indeed, the farther back in time we are gazing. And on the account of the universe expanding after an original Big Bang, our earthly point of observation, as any point of observation, is indeed a genuine observational center, equidistant from the edges of the universe. And if we look deep enough into space, to those very edges, what we are in a sense seeing, or rather not seeing, but only imagining, or not even that, maybe attaining by a process of mental abstraction, is the origin of the universe at the beginning of time, not something large and farther away, but if we look far enough back in time or outside of the physical present, an infinitesimally small point, an all-in-one primum mobile that paradoxically encompasses the rest of spatiotemporal universe. For Dante, with God as this point, the saints are arrayed around him in a celestial rose, like the petals of a blooming flower. Even this, however, is a useful but deceptive visualization of an intimate spiritual communion that necessarily transcends our imagination. In general, while Dante's hell and purgatory were full of wonders actually encountered and described in concrete detail, in paradise, imagination and even speech reach their limits. Passing beyond the human cannot be worded, he says in the first canto. This is the poetic challenge of Paradiso, and one of the reasons why people say it is the most boring canticle. I think Dante more than meets the challenge, and that Paradiso, like all great literature, tests the character of its readers. Paradiso judges those who judge it boring. There is certainly enough in Dante's vision of heaven to delight the imagination, so long as it is an imagination disciplined and enlightened by philosophy. Although Dante in Paradiso has left behind Virgil, the paragon of pagan philosophy, and is now accompanied by the graced Beatrice, there are a surprising number of philosophical conversations in heaven, starting from the very beginning. Beatrice, explaining to Dante the physics of him starting to fall up towards the heavens, gives a very Aristotelian lesson in formal and final causes, that is, actualizing principles which imbue things with intrinsic impulses towards their proper ends. All things, she says, among themselves possess an order, and this order is the form that makes the universe like God. Within that order, ever nature has its bent, according to a different station, nearer or less near to its origin. We might say that, thanks to their origin in God, the forms of rational creatures, which give them their being, orders them to know, to grasp intelligible truth, and to love, to seek the good and appreciate it as beautiful. In the second canto, Beatrice gives lessons in epistemology, including the limitations of the senses and reason. She also continues the lesson in Aristotelian physics. Invited to try to account for the spots on the moon, Dante has already forgotten the lesson in formal causes from Canto 1 and offers a purely materialist account in terms of the relative densities of their material parts. So Beatrice reminds him, different powers must be fruits of different formal principles. And she discourses at length about the refraction of light, culminating in a powerful image in anticipation of God. I would offer now to you a new form, light so living that it trembles in your sight. Within the heaven of the godly peace revolves a body in whose power lies the being of all things that it enfolds. The words recall the very opening lines of Paradiso, which I quoted earlier. The glory of the one who moves all things, permeates the universe, and glows in one part more and in another less. Canto 3 extends this lesson in physics to a more proper lesson in metaphysics. It begins with Dante praising the illumination that Beatrice had just provided. That sun, he says, which first had warmed my breast with love, had now revealed to me, confuting, proving the gentle face of truth, its loveliness. What is loved here, the good which is desired and appreciated and sought by the will, is precisely truth, the good of the intellect, and this truth has a sweet aspect. It is lovely, something beautiful, with even a hint of the personal. In the lowest heaven, Dante meets Picarda and asks her if she wishes she were higher. She explains the contentment of all souls in heaven. Picarda's humility is lovely, and her personal story matters, but it too is part of a philosophical lesson. Everything in heaven is in place. It has its order and harmony. There is no conflict, nor even need for development or future resolution. One of the challenges Dante faced in writing about heaven is that, with the sole exception of Dante, the character progressing towards God, there can be no movement in heaven. Movement or change implies deficiency, a good sought but not yet attained. And yet, as Dante the poet strove to show, in heaven, this lack of movement isn't static or lifeless or inert. Precisely because the souls are fulfilled and arrayed in their proper places, they constitute a living harmony, like the robust, sustaining metabolism of a vibrant organism. So that there is not movement in the sense of development towards an end, precisely because there is more life, more self-fulfilling activity, in a state of maintaining what is enjoying an already realized and ever realizing end. The permanence or changelessness of heaven is not due to a deficiency of power, but to an abundance of ordered power. Instead of violence, gentleness. Instead of struggle, peace. Instead of becoming, being. Hence the ever-present image of that classic sensible sign of divinity, light, which shines forth without depleting itself, which shares without being divided, an image of warmth, like love, of illumination, like truth, and of shining splendor, beauty. It is in Canto 4 that Beatrice explains that the various encounters in the separate spheres are misleading, an imaginative device, an artistic condescension or conceit. All these souls grace the Empyrean, she says. They showed themselves to you here not because this is their sphere, but as a sign to you. Such signs are suited to your mind, since from the senses only can it apprehend what then becomes fit for the intellect. Notably, in defending the poetic fiction of paradise's spheres, Beatrice invokes a thoroughly conventional Aristotelian epistemological lesson. There is nothing in the intellect which is not first in the senses. Suffice it to say that the metaphysical and epistemological principles continue to inform the political and theological considerations of rational human beings in the next several cantos, all on the theme of justice, including discourses on free will and vows in Canto 5, on political rule in Canto 6, and on the logic of the incarnation and atonement in Canto 7. The political implications of metaphysics continue with a discussion of providence in Canto 8. Human beings, as rational animals, are naturally political animals. Under God's providence, we have providence over our own actions. Citizenship, that is, membership in a community, perfects human beings. This thoroughly Aristotelian point, which also informed St. Thomas's structure of the Summa Theologiae, then transitions to Canto 9, which draws on specifically Christian faith to describe the need for the special community of the church, and on the gift of prophecy to promise the church's renewal. In the 10th canto, we meet the theologians, and especially the one who speaks more than any other character in Paradiso besides the three principals, Dante, Beatrice, and any other character in the whole Divine Comedy, Dante, Beatrice, and Virgil. More lines even than the contemplative guide, Bernard. St. Thomas Aquinas is one in a ring of 12 theologians. Too much ink has been spilled over the inclusion of another theologian, very different from Aquinas, named Siger of Brabant. Does this mean Dante was signaling that he wasn't really a Thomist, some modern readers ask, conspiratorially? They could as well observe, look how generous and synthetic, how methodologically Thomistic is Dante's vision of theology. In other respects, too, while allowing Thomas to be the primary theological spokesman, Dante seems to insist on a harmonized diversity of temperaments and voices and intellectual charisms among the theologians. Thomas's circle includes Bede and Boethius, Isidore and Dionysius, and a second circle of 12 more theologians is led by a Franciscan, Bonaventure, and includes Anselm and Chrysostom, Augustine and Hugh of St. Victor, just to name a few. After we hear the theologians praise each other in Cantos 10, 11, and 12, St. Thomas gives in Canto 13 a remarkable defense of the practical dimension of wisdom, its power to rule, its kingliness, which is also a point directly out of Aristotle's Metaphysics. The theoretical ability to make conceptual distinctions is, of course, a prerequisite of the practical ability to make decisions. And St. Thomas orients the whole study of theology to ends beyond the schools and beyond pure theoretical speculation. Spiritual humility and prudence in judging are the purpose of theology. The scholar Mandonet said that Dante establishes St. Thomas as the master of the practical order, since prudence is the first moral virtue and the one which governs the others. At the same time, Thomas is also defending the superior wisdom of God, whose own providence over creation produces results that may be mysterious and inscrutable to us. Prudence and our active subjection to an active providence. These two themes are reflected in the most common metaphors of Paradiso, the archer's arrow and the nursing babe. Archery is one of the most ancient metaphors for prudential judgment, the responsibility of choice ordered to an end. And Dante thrice compares himself to a baby being fed by his mother, an attitude of humility and gratitude for generosity. Looking ahead, the poet will deploy three instances of the suckling infant metaphor, each in a different mode. First, as having been sated, implying completion or fulfillment in Canto 23. Then, as greedily hungry, deprived, and anticipating a future fulfillment in Canto 30. And finally, in the act of feeding, actively being satisfied in an ongoing present in Canto 33. With Thomas and the theologians, we are only halfway up the planetary heavens, in the sphere of the sun, with Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn before us. I do not have time to survey the rest of heaven thoroughly, but if I did, we would note the continuing persistence of Aristotelian categories, even in explaining specifically Christian doctrines. In Canto 26, Dante says that arguments from Aristotle helped him to know that God is love. In Cantos 27 and 28, he describes the center of the universe as the mind of God, quoting Aristotle's Metaphysics. Canto 29 expounds on angelic intellection by comparison with Aristotelian psychology, and it also includes a diatribe against vain philosophy, bad theology, and thoughtless preaching. I could go on, but resting here for a moment in the sphere of the sun with St. Thomas is as good a point as any to reflect on the order of all the spheres and how Dante used them symbolically. I already mentioned that he correlates the seven planetary spheres with the seven liberal arts and with the Dionysian angelic hierarchy. But another important correlation is an association of the spheres with the virtues. For Dante, the highest four planetary spheres correspond with the four cardinal virtues. The sun, the sphere of the theologians, as we have seen, is the sphere of prudence. Mars, the sphere of the martyrs, corresponds with courage. Jupiter, the sphere of political rulers, signifies justice. And Saturn, the sphere of contemplatives, corresponds to temperance. Beneath these, the first three spheres are correlated with the three theological virtues. Those who broke vows show, by deficiency, the virtue of faith. Seekers of glory correspond to the virtue of hope, and the troubled lovers remind us of charity. Now, given the unity of the virtues and the necessity of God's grace, all the virtues, you might think, must be present in all the saints in heaven, and so at all the levels in heaven, at least the cardinal virtues and charity, since technically faith and hope are no longer necessary among the blessed. We can allow that just as Dante the poet has the saints to be imaginatively divided into different spheres for the sake of Dante the protagonist's spiritual journey, so he has the saints at each level to highlight one or another of the virtues. But even so, it is worth noting some puzzling and provocative features of Dante's imaginative construct. First, Just note that the theological virtues come first, followed by the cardinal virtues. Second, the sphere of the theologians corresponds with the intellectual virtue of prudence guiding action, not with the pure intellectual virtue of wisdom. Third, the theologians are thereby clearly distinguished from the contemplatives, who are set three levels above with the outermost planet in the seventh heaven. Fourth, those contemplatives are associated with what is typically thought to be the most basic of the practical virtues, temperance, moderation, self-control, not an intellectual perfection at all, but a regulation of appetite. So fifth, Dante's ordering seems to reverse the classical order of the cardinal virtues, which in Aristotle's Ethics or in Plato's Republic would seem to start with the lower, temperance, proceed through the other two practical virtues, courage and justice, and end with the intellectual perfection of prudence or even wisdom last. These observations each raise puzzles, but from the perspective of classical philosophical ethics, what should be most puzzling of all is the idea that courage, justice, temperance, and prudence should be virtues in heaven at all. In Aristotelian terms, these are the practical virtues, or the virtues of the political life, as distinct from the contemplative life. And from a conventional Aristotelian perspective, it seems that all of the saints in heaven should be contemplatives, with the virtue of wisdom, knowing God, and the practical or political virtues should have fallen away. Isn't that, from the Thomistic perspective, exactly how Christian hope in the afterlife helps resolve the Aristotelian tension found between the political and contemplative lives? Contemplation may be better for us, but it is not fully possible given our mortal nature. Christian faith opens up the possibility for sustained contemplation in heaven, leaving behind the earthly concerns of practical judgment. Why, then, would Dante put prudence, justice, courage, and temperance in heaven, much less so high in heaven? I believe there is an answer to this question, a reason why Dante did not leave the practical virtues out of heaven. And I believe that Dante took guidance here from Thomas Aquinas and from a Neoplatonic source on which St. Thomas himself drew. Let us grant that insofar as all the saints are enjoying the beatific vision, they are all contemplatives. But it is also true that insofar as they are all virtuous, they must have all the proper perfections of a virtuous soul, even if their souls have been raised to a higher mode of existence in heaven. As a poet, Dante would, of course, want some excuse to make heaven more vibrant and interesting. And as a theologian and philosopher, he would want a good reason to characterize the full range of virtues in heaven. He found both, inspiration both poetic and philosophical, in an important and obvious literary precedent for placing the so-called practical virtues in heaven and placing them with saints, not only by historical association with the saint's previous earthly life, but as continuing to be actively manifest in the souls of those saints, but transposed into a higher mode. That source is the Neoplatonic Macrobius' commentary on a passage from Cicero's Republic called The Dream of Scipio. We know that Macrobius is a source for much else in Paradiso. On the virtues specifically, in Book 1, Chapter 8, Macrobius describes the four cardinal virtues, first in a fairly conventional way, as regulating the passions of earthly life. But then he cites the great Neoplatonist Plotinus, and scholars agree he must actually have had in mind the work of Plotinus's student Porphyry, on a fourfold classification and hierarchy of the set of cardinal virtues. Above the first or commonly known political level, already described, is a second level, which he calls cleansing or purifying. While on the political plane, the cardinal virtues fit us for social life, on the purifying plane, they orient us to God and perfect those who have withdrawn from practical concerns to seek wisdom for its own sake. Above these two levels, the political and the purifying, which are both fit for human beings in this life, the cardinal virtues have a manifestation on a third level, the purified. At this stage, Macrobius says the mind is completely and thoroughly cleansed from all taint of this world, These virtues seem genuinely otherworldly, and Macrobius attributes them to separated souls, describing each one in terms fit for souls unmixed with anything earthly. It is the part of prudence, he says, not to prefer the divine as though there were any choice, but to know it alone and to fix one's attention upon it as if there were nothing else. It is the part of temperance not to restrain earthly longing, but to forget them completely. It is the part of courage to ignore the passions, not to suppress them. And it is the part of justice to be so attached to the divine heavenly mind as to keep an everlasting covenant with it by imitating it. Thus Macrobius. So described, the virtues are still recognizably the cardinal virtues, and yet no longer about the practical exigencies of earthly life or resisting the temptations of the flesh. These are virtues of saints in beatitude. Here, the cardinal virtues do not mitigate the passions or even put passions aside. They have totally forgotten the passions. Macrobius describes a higher, final, fourth level where the cardinal virtues are manifest beyond the level of the blessed, in God himself. These he calls the exemplar virtues, in the sense that God, who is first efficient cause and ultimate final cause, is also himself the ultimate formal cause, the pure actuality from which all other actuality derives, and so the original exemplar of all perfections. The exemplar virtues are thus, Macrobius says, present in the divine mind itself from the pattern of which all the other virtues are derived. Human conceptions are misleading here, because the exemplar virtues are not only present in the divine mind. They, in fact, are the divine mind, conceived in different modes by us. Here is Macrobius describing the exemplar cardinal virtues as God himself. The divine mind, he says, itself is prudence. It is temperance because it always looks back upon itself with unremitting attention. It is courage because it is always the same and never changed. It is justice because by eternal law, it never turns from constant application of its work. Now, Dante knew well Macrobius' exposition of this Neoplatonic hierarchy of virtues. But even if he had not, he could have found in St. Thomas not only a summary of it, but a license to integrate it into a Christian account of beatitude. In the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas explicitly asks whether the cardinal virtues are divided into political, purifying, purified, and exemplar virtues, directly citing Macrobius. Invoking support also from Augustine, Plotinus, and Aristotle, Aquinas answers, yes. The body of his article essentially quotes Macrobius. Here is St. Thomas. The exemplar of human virtue must pre-exist in God, just as in him pre-exist the exemplars of all things. Accordingly, virtue may be considered as existing originally in God, and thus we speak of exemplar virtues, so that in God, the divine mind itself may be called prudence, while temperance is the turning of God's gaze on himself, even as in us it is that which conforms the appetite to reason. God's fortitude is his unchangeableness. His justice is the observation of the eternal law in his works. Aquinas even places this query at a pivotal moment in his Summa. It is the last article, the fifth, in the question about cardinal virtues, number 61, in the first part of the second part, effectively marking a transition from the cardinal moral virtues to the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity in question 62. Some interpreters have argued that Dante is a creative syncretist and therefore not a Thomist. I would argue that he is a Thomist because of the manner of his creative syncretism. Can you imagine a Christian theologian using a pagan Neoplatonist conception of a hierarchy of virtue in order to characterize the beatific vision and suggest a connection between cardinal and theological virtues? You say no true Thomist would do such a thing? Aquinas himself did exactly that. When Dante tries to recount what he saw when granted a vision of God, before it gazes back at him with a human face, the face of Christ, What he describes is something pure, unchanging, perfect, whole and still, a living glow, brilliant and profoundest being. This is the unmoved mover of Aristotle, pure actuality, thinking, loving, being itself, and also the shining living exemplar of Plato and Neoplatonism. Now, to identify these philosophical sources is certainly not to invite an interpretation in dry or technical abstract terms. My point is that Dante found poetic fecundity already in these philosophical sources. It is the very God of the philosophers who is already imagined as an overwhelming, ineffable, awe-inspiring, pure presence, something gloriously and wholly what it is, the original and preeminent source of all being. It takes nothing away from Dante's poetic genius to notice that with support from Aquinas, he could find inspiration for his creative vision in the Neoplatonic tradition of characterizing God not only as good or goodness itself, but as something more personal, as justice and temperance and courage and prudence itself, as a living exemplar of self-seeking virtue in which every rational creature can only imperfectly participate. I'm at my conclusion, and so I should talk about that triad of beauty, truth, and goodness, which we have all heard about. They grace the crests of private schools, they inspire classical and Christian curriculum, and even structure the climactic philosophical dialogue of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Huxley has his characters talk about truth, beauty, and goodness in that order. They've been operative throughout my talk, and I could have easily made them the centerpiece or linchpin of this exposition of Dante. Pope Paul VI did exactly that in his 1965 appreciation of Dante, the Motu Proprio Altissimi Cantus. Here is Pope Paul VI. Theology and philosophy, he says, are intrinsically related to beauty. To their teachings, beauty lends its own vesture and adornment. Through music and the figurative and plastic arts, beauty opens a path that makes their lofty teachings accessible to many others. Erudite disquisitions and subtle reasonings are not easily understood by many people, yet they too hunger for the bread of truth. Attracted by beauty, they come to recognize and appreciate the light of truth and the fulfillment it brings. This is what the Lord of Sublime Song understood and achieved. For him, beauty became the handmaid of goodness and truth, and goodness a thing of beauty. Thus Pope Paul VI. Let me call beauty, truth, and goodness the transcendental triad. Transcendental because they are often described in the philosophical tradition as convertible with being, that is, differing only in connotation but entirely overlapping in scope with being. Everything that is, insofar as it is good, is true, and is beautiful. I have not ignored this transcendental triad, but I have been trying to point toward another triad that I believe was even more operative for Dante as poet and as theologian, a triad more active, more dynamic, describing God and participation in God. Being, thinking, living. Others have called this the Neoplatonic triad, since it is found in Plotinus and Proclus, but it is Neoplatonic in the broader sense that it also incorporates Aristotle. It describes the prime mover or first substance in the metaphysics as thinking and as living. The danger of the transcendental triad is that it can be abstracted from theology and from spirituality, from the personal journey of loving and willing. Beauty, truth, and goodness are names for God, but they can be treated instead as names for theoretical objects, for concepts, even as a means for designating separate theoretical disciplines, aesthetics seeking beauty, morals seeking goodness, and science or epistemology seeking truth. This is what in fact happened in the late modern period under the influence of Kant and Victor Cousin, for instance. The triad, beauty, truth, and goodness, does retain its power to turn our attention back to the classical and Christian wisdom tradition, and it often has. But historically, a focus on this triad is part of a modern post-theological and even anti-theological turn in philosophy. That is the risk in focusing on beauty, truth, and goodness, that they can be reduced to concepts, objects of our thought and attention, but rather than active powers or living principles animating us and animating our source and purpose, they are abstract. I suggest that we correct for this by recalling that they are names of God, and so associate them with many other names of God, including names that are harder to reduce to inert abstractions. Dionysius, the Christian Neoplatonist author of the famous Divine Names Treatise, treats good and beautiful early in chapter 4, but he also treats their light and love and ecstasy. A couple chapters later, he treats life. In chapter 7, he treats truth, but along with truth, he treats mind and wisdom, an active power and the virtue of that power. Late in the treatise, Dionysius treats another divine name, less commonly reflected on, but central to the classical and Christian tradition, and central to Dante's Divine Comedy, peace. Dionysius makes clear, peace is not merely the absence of conflict, but a preeminently active, living, sustaining, and generating power, a harmony of sustaining presence. Pope Paul VI, whom I quoted earlier, highlighting beauty, truth, and goodness, also characterized peace as Dante's ultimate theme. The Divine Comedy, he says, is a poem of peace. The Inferno, a dirge for peace forever lost. The Purgatorio, a wistful hymn of hope for peace. And the Paradiso, a triumphant anthem of peace fully and eternally possessed. Dante knew a beautiful truth, and he knew it with the help of Aristotelian Neoplatonic philosophy. We seek goodness and truth and beauty because these are ways that an active God is, and ways that God actively appeals to us to draw us toward himself. God has made us to seek them and to know that he will bring us peace because God is peace, a glorious peace, a peace of shining splendor and generous love and ecstatic harmony. And our only peace is an active participation in love with the beauty of his unfathomable divine life. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.